I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. Since this is my final episode as host of Only a Game, I have decided that we'll go easy on the NFL this week. I'm just kidding. I'm joined by the Ringer's Claire McNear. Welcome back, Claire.
Great to be here.
And by NBC Sports' Craig Calcaterra. Craig, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I give you the headlines of three football-related stories this week. Number one, NFL owners want players to stand for the national anthem. Two, NFL owners told to stay quiet about national anthem policy. And three, Cowboys Jerry Jones defies NFL with his own national anthem policy. The league and the Players Association have apparently been trying to come to some sort of resolution on this issue. Meanwhile, Jerry Jones has said his players are going to stand. My suggestion is to leave the players alone. They have playbooks to memorize this time of year, but it's not very likely that anybody's going to take my suggestion seriously, is it, Claire?
Yeah, I am sorry to say that I agree with that assessment. This is the debate that just won't stop. During the last week of the 2017 NFL regular season, there were just seven players who kneeled. Seven! And it wasn't because those who had been kneeling earlier in the year or the year before were forced to stop or were fined by team owners or were told to stay in the locker room. Many of the players who'd taken part in the inequality protests on the field had come out and said that they were pleased with what they'd accomplished and they were going to continue their activism in other ways, and maybe through team action in the communities or through their personal foundations, you name it. But then this offseason, the owners started talking about formalizing a penalty for players who kneel, and reportedly this was to keep the debate from being politicized in the way it was last year. And of course, it did the exact opposite. And the president is once again sending out tweets about it and applauding Jerry Jones on his announced policy. And here we are once more.
Some of the owners believe that the kneeling, the protests, the optics is the phrase these days. That's why NFL ratings are down a little bit. Craig, do you think that that is an explanation or part of the explanation?
I think it's totally bogus. There's really no evidence for that. I saw a report last week that NFL revenue is up, NFL ratings aren't down appreciably or you know, really in a significant way once you control for all the other reasons why various ratings might go up or down. There's really nothing here other than a lot of noise, and it's being amplified by the megaphone that is Donald Trump. And I think that's the biggest problem here is the NFL owners are about the only entity in the country that takes President Trump extraordinarily seriously and tries to figure out policies to deal with this guy.
Claire, what do you got for us?
Well, I would say on a lighter note, but I think that depends on which baseball team you root for. But it's another baseball season, so that means it's another year of New York Mets dysfunction, dare I say, cataclysm. This time around, we have Noah Syndergaard on the disabled list with, of all things, hand, foot, and mouth disease. Mm. Then there's Yenis Cespedes, who just returned from his own two-month stint on the DL, only to announce he needs surgery on both heels that has a minimum recovery time of 8 months. And meanwhile, poor Jacob deGrom is pitching what could go down as a historically great season, and the Mets are barely able to win his games. So at a certain point, I think all these years of rotten luck in Queens start to look like incompetence. So I guess I wonder where the line is between bad luck and just screwing up over and over and over.
Well, first I will say that as someone who at one point had a toddler who gave him hand, foot, and mouth disease, I sympathize greatly with Noah Syndergaard. It is no joke, and it is the dumbest and worst thing that you could possibly get. As for the rest of it, yeah, it's bad luck on one level, but as Branch Rickey once famously said, luck is the residue of design, and the Mets are an incompetently run organization, I would say from top to bottom, but it's primarily the top. Ownership and most of the people they have put in charge in positions of authority have just not been good folks. And one of the things that happens there is, whether it's team medical officials or the front office, the Mets are notoriously bad about putting players on the disabled list for minor injuries, and they often become major injuries. Even Cespedes, after he was saying he couldn't walk, was still on the active roster. No one has ever really gotten a good explanation from the Mets for why they proceed this way. But then again, they have the son of the owner who is sort of micromanaging the team, and no one asks him any hard questions anyway because he's the son of the owner.
You know, it's interesting to me when the two of you talk about what's wrong with the Mets and you use terms like historically badly managed and stuff like that. When you use terms like that, you're talking about 10, 12 years ago. When I use terms like historically, I'm talking about the Mets when they first came into existence in New York, and I was still mourning the departure of the New York Giants for San Francisco, and Casey Stengel was their manager, and according to the players, he would sometimes fall asleep before the fifth inning and sometimes just after it. These are the Mets that I remember with great fondness, so maybe it's just the wheel, the great karmic wheel is turning, and we're back.
I think the modern Mets actually leverage that. They know that people with a memory back into the 60s see what was way, way worse and say, come on, we're not that bad.
Yeah, but they're not funny. They used to be funny.
They're not funny at all. I don't think anyone is laughing. And this is a team that was in the World Series just 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I guess my parting note would be maybe give the Mets fans in your life a hug.
Yeah, but maybe not, because at least,
one of them has a terrible disease. Yeah, we'll wash your hands afterwards.
There you go. Craig, I understand that baseball is also on your mind.
Oh, it's always on my mind. We set a record in Major League Baseball earlier this week when the 31st and 32nd position player, non-pitcher, pitched in a major league game, and we have since had at least two or three more in the past week. Now, this is a phenomenon that's always happened in baseball, normally in a blowout, but it's happening far more often now, and it's even happening in non-blowouts. The Dodgers on Monday night brought in utility guy Kike Hernandez to pitch in a tie game in extra innings, and he gave up a walk-off home run to the Phillies.
Oops.
Yeah, really oops. It's interesting, though, that this is happening now because we are in an age in baseball where the pitching staffs are bigger than they have ever been. Most teams carry 13 or 14 pitchers. Baseball's pitcher usage is now such that guys use maximum effort throwing 100 miles per hour, and it is a successful mission for them if they can pitch one inning or sometimes two. It's evolution in baseball, but it's one that I find very frustrating, especially if I happen to be rooting for a team that uses a utility guy to give up a walk-off home run in the 16th inning.
Claire, there has been discussion for some time about trying to make baseball more entertaining for younger fans. Do you suppose that this is a part of that effort?
I mean, I think there's probably a line between entertaining flailing and just outright chaos, and maybe we're leaning a little bit more towards the latter. I mean, the crazy thing to me is that this seems to have all happened at once. Like Craig said, you know, the hyper-specialization of pitchers and the growth of pitching staffs and relievers in particular, you know, has been going on for a while now, but it's suddenly this season that teams seem to have decided kind of in unison almost to start tossing in guys like poor Kike Hernandez, who I believe was the first position player ever to give off a walk-off home run. Mm. And you know what? I think it's a slippery slope. And if you can signal an intentional walk, who's to say you can't signal a mid-game surrender? So I see Rob Manfred's fingerprints all over this.
Yeah. You know, I think it's only fair to mention the flip side of this syndrome. The other night, the Yankees and the Rays were playing, and an actual relief pitcher, Sergio Romo, came in to pitch for Tampa. And he got his guy out, and then he moved over and played third base. And then in the ninth inning, he moved back over from third base and pitched the ninth inning and got the save. As I understand it, was the first guy since 1913 to play third base and get credited with a save in the same game. Joe Gedeon did that in 1913, and that was an interesting achievement because nobody knew that there was such a thing as a save until 1969. So I feel bad for Joe Gedeon. He died in 1941, but I wonder if he's retroactively upset that his record was tied.
I will give the Rays a lot of credit, though, for moving Sergio Romo to third base. Kevin Cash, the manager, mentioned after the game, and he was absolutely right. Greg Bird was batting for the Yankees, and they looked at his charts, and he never hits it to third base, so we figured that's where we could hide Romo, and he was absolutely right. That's some next-level thinking. Way to go, Rays.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Ringer's Claire McNear. Claire, thank you very much.
Great to be here.
And NBC Sports' Craig Calcaterra. Craig, thanks.
Thank you, Bill, and happy trails.
Thank you very much.